Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're, can we call this the Valentine hangover?
Yeah, this is post-Valentine.
Too much bubbly.
And the good news for all your listeners is On the Menu is giving you a dispensation. Because we forgot, we're so far ahead, we forgot last week. We should have wished everybody a happy Valentine's Day last Sunday.
We mentioned it already.
Did we?
Yes.
Last week?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize we mentioned it already last week.
We mentioned it for the first time in years. We actually didn't cover the chocolates and hearts and things.
Yeah, there you go. Well, anyway, first up today, and this is for listeners across the world, around the world for that matter. You have a chance to buy back the favor of the one you love in case you forgot or in case you didn't give quite as generous as you might have, because the 10th anniversary Charleston Wine and Food Festival is coming up in the very near future, starting on March 4th in the charming city of Charleston, South Carolina. We had the opportunity to catch up with the director of communications for the festival to get her thoughts on what it's like to be 10 years old and what is going to make this year's Charleston Wine and Food Festival even more special than it has been in the past. So here we have Catherine Zomer telling you all about it. When a food and wine festival reaches year 10, has it become a mummy and daddy of food and wine festivals yet? there are some that have been running longer, but none of them, I think, developing as well as the one that we are going to talk about today, which it celebrates its 10th year this year in the wonderful, charming southern city of Charleston. And we have Catherine Zomer, who is the Director of Communications for the festival, with us today to tell you all about what a wonderful time it's going to be and encourage you that it's not too late to sign up and get down there and enjoy some southern hospitality. Catherine, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, we go to a lot of festivals, but there is a charm about this one that I can only attribute to where it is, Charleston itself.
Charleston is the star of our wine and food festival, absolutely. There is just nothing like coming down to the low country. We've just got such beautiful sunsets and delicious seafood, and of course we've got some great award-winning chefs. Our downtown is just rich with culinary experiences, and so the festival really takes that to the next level with folks coming in to collaborate with our local chefs and winemakers, and it's a really wonderful 5 days.
And it takes place directly in the heart of the city.
It sure does. The festival takes place really downtown in our historic Marion Square. That's really where the heart of the festival is, which is our culinary village, and that runs from Friday, March 6th through Sunday, March 8th. And it's at our culinary village that you can really have a lot of experiences. This year, we actually have 13 unique experiences in that downtown square, ranging from our grand tasting tent, which is presented by Baker Motor Company, and that features chefs and purveyors and winemakers, to our artisan market, which really showcases local handcrafted goods and samples, of course. And then this year, we've actually added a new third space tent, which is an area that's really devoted to fostering community and coming together. And that's actually where we're going to have over 60 chef demos throughout the weekend. And we're really excited. A new area for us. And chefs will be coming in mainly from Charleston, but they will also be partnering with guest chefs, demo all sorts of different delicious foods with different themes. So we've got earth and air, land, sea, and fire all represented.
Oh, wow. That's really...
It's just an amazingly wonderful thing to have a city park, if you like, that little grassland that just happens to be available for these kinds of events. But it functions as just lungs for Charleston during the rest of the year, right? There isn't a permanent funfair or anything like that. It's just an open space until you fill it up.
Exactly, yes. Well, it does during the spring and summer. It hosts our farmers market on Saturday mornings. And it's also a very popular square for the College of Charleston kids to go and sunbathe and hang out. But, yeah, it really transforms the first weekend of March every year to host the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
Now, you seem to be starting a day earlier than usual. Am I correct about that? The opening gala, which is the first event you shouldn't miss, is actually on Wednesday.
It is. We have extended the festival slightly this year, and our opening night gala is on Wednesday, March 4th, and that is going to be in a grand tent in the heart of Marion Square. We're going back to our roots, and really it's going to be quite a festive gala. Over 25 Charleston chefs come together to prepare their perfect recipes. This year, actually, the inspiration is the Junior League of Charleston's Charleston Receipts, which is a sort scattered over the decades that are recipes that are very Charlestonian in nature, and that's serving as the inspiration for our opening night gala. So we're really excited to bring in that history component to the flavors of the evening.
Could you name some of the participating chefs?
Oh, goodness, yes. We've got a lot of great folk. Sean Brock is participating, Mike Latta from Fig and the Ordinary with Jason Stanhope, Michelle Weaver from the Charleston Grill,
Jeremiah Bacon from
the McIntosh and Oak, Mark Collins, the chef who actually asked the question that started our festival. He asked, why didn't Charleston have a wine and food festival back in 2005? And here we are today. So he'll be participating. Kevin Johnson, who is our chef chair for our board for the festival. He runs the grocery, and he'll be there. Frank Lee, of course.
We love Frank.
Yeah, he's incredible. From the Maverick Kitchen Group, Snob, and High Cotton, he'll be there. So just a wonderful representation of different chefs, but it really is a focus and a celebration of Charleston chefs that opening night.
They're all friends. I mean, I really, that's another aspect of this. You feel like you're at a family event, a family party.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, what makes the Charleston Wine and Food Festival so special. That is definitely, you feel that from chefs, you feel that from the purveyors and the artisans that all come together to put these 5 days on. We're really a great southern community.
Now, tell us about some of these wonderful dinners, because they're big events in their own right, and you just released some tickets for some of them. But tell us some more about this dinner series.
Every year we put on dinners, which are hosted at restaurants throughout Charleston. This year they are called our signature dinners. And the reason we call them our signature dinners is we're really allowing the Charleston chefs to put their signature on to the dinner this year. In the past, it's always been five courses. A guest chef will come in, and our local chef and guest chef will work together with a winemaker. This year, it's similar. There will be guest chefs partnering with local chefs and with winemakers coming in, but they are going to be, some of them will be five courses, some maybe eight courses.
Wow.
So they're really been tasked to flex their creative muscles here and really put out something spectacular that would be unforgettable.
And what are some of those chefs, the visiting chefs?
Yeah, so we've got Anne Quatuano coming in.
Oh, I love Anne.
She's
fabulous.
Great.
Yeah, I've known her for probably 20 years, easily, I think.
Yeah, you'll see her, and Vivian Howard will be here. She is going to be cooking at High Cotton. So we've got folks coming in from everywhere, from Nashville to the West Coast. Gabrielle Hamilton is coming down from New York, from Croon.
She's everywhere these days.
Well, she just came out with a new book. So,
she's
out and about. Of course, Frank Stitt will be here. He's hosting one of our big special dinners called North, South, East, West, and that brings together chefs and winemakers from across the country.
Oh, wow.
And that's going to be really, that's kind of our big...
The big one.
Dinner, yeah. Carmen Quagliato and Michael Tusk will be cooking there.
Oh, Michael Tusk, how fabulous.
Yeah, Michael's great.
He's absolutely terrific. Just in case you're thinking, listeners, it's all about food, we should be sure to point out that there are a number of beverage events. There are some beer events, there are some brown spirit events, and there are some great wine events. Give us a little bit of a snapshot of those before we go.
We are delighted. Our beverage director this year is Patrick Emerson, who is a master sommelier, and he's put together some really exceptional beverage seminars. There's going to be a distiller for a day workshop where you can go into a distillery and really learn up close and personal what it's like to run a distillery.
Wow.
So and that's going to be here in Charleston with a local distiller, High Wire. Then we've got some great wine events. We've got a Burgundy tasting that's happening. We've got the Mondavi families coming to taste. Quintessa will be here to do a vertical tasting. The Wines and Ciders of Virginia are doing a seminar. We've, of course, got some great cocktail-focused seminars, one with Charlotte Voisy called Tap Your Inner Mixologist, where folks can really take their home bartending skills to the next level. One wine seminar that we're really excited about is called From Deep Below, and this is a wine event 150 years in the making.
Oh, yeah, we know about this one. Somebody sank some wine in the river, right?
Well, there was a blockade runner ship back in 1864 that sank off the coast of Bermuda, and divers discovered a case of wine that seemed perfectly intact, and there's always that possibility, if it's a Madeira, that it's held up and has some integrity, so we'll be opening a bottle from this shipwreck on Friday late afternoon with some top sommeliers and wine experts there to test the wine and really experience it and see what we've got.
Now, didn't somebody do a sort of a modern copy of that?
It was a
modern winemaker who wanted to experiment with aging of wine in a different environment.
Underwater, yeah. That's actually a winery here in Charleston,
okay,
the Mira Winery, and they're actually participating in a number of different events with the festival as well. So they're still in the trial phases of that.
Right,
program,
right.
As I understand it.
Seems like a fun idea. But that's, when it comes right down to it, that's what this event is all about, isn't it? It's all about having fun and doing it in a city that, the first time I went to Charleston was, I think, 1973. And it seemed to me then that Charleston was kind of staid and kind of dull. And the years since then, it has transformed itself.
Because you got to know better.
Is that what it was?
Know more people. Okay, so we're not outsiders
anymore. So there's so much more energy there. But you can also take it easy when you feel like it as well.
I mean, Charleston really has the best of so many worlds. We're obviously just a few miles from the coast, so the beaches are right here. And, of course, that lends itself to some incredible estuaries and seafood, which is makes it quite special. But then we've got downtown and King Street, and there's a lot of incredible restaurants and cocktail bars, and there's a growing number of local breweries here, so it really is a paradise for foodies.
Well, I'm going to mention, by the way, King Street. I tell everybody going to Charleston, go shoe shopping. They have the most fabulous shoe shops in Charleston.
We have great shops here. We also have a really thriving arts community, so there are some fantastic galleries. And, of course, the history. Charleston is just such a historic city, so you can meander through the cobblestone streets and go south of Broad and see the mansions down there and the gardens.
Yeah, that's where I want to live.
Yeah, there's a really nice house there on King Street, way down.
There are some beautiful houses. We've actually got a number of events for the festival this year happening in private homes and in residences all throughout those communities. So a lot of our wine events are happening homes, so you really get to go in and experience Charleston in a new way.
So, amazing.
So here you are, listeners. Let your fingers do the walking, as they say. Go to www.charlestonwineandfood.com and be a part of it, as we are going to be, and we'll see you there.
Come toast the decade with us.
Yes. Catherine, thank you so much. I can't wait.
We're so looking forward.
And we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. It's always nice, of course, to find someplace special in your own backyard. And recently we did just that. I must say that we've been longtime fans of the Kimpton chain of restaurants, and we have one in Pittsburgh now called the Monaco.
At last. We have a
charming in its own right, and we really love the restaurant in this place called the Commoner, and we love the chef, and we just had the best time there, and it's Dennis Marin, like in that The Blue Shellfish, which is another old story.
Altogether, yeah. turned out Chef Dennis had never heard of an Australian freshwater lobster called a Marin, with two R's, just like his name. So we regaled him with the story of how we not only met one for the first time, but ate one for the first time.
Mikey. Anyhow, let's listen to what we had. You're going to like the vibes of this place. Let's listen to Dennis, who we like a lot. Dennis Marin, you were anticipated, or your arrival was anticipated by everybody eagerly, happily, your arrival in Pittsburgh from D.C. And you are heading up this wonderful kitchen. I mean, I saw it under construction, and then I saw it completed. And boy, what a lot of work that was. The restaurant's called The Commoner, and you also deal with the Commoner Corner, do you not?
I do. We have Corner, which is a meat carvery, or like kind of a grab-and-go deli, and then The Commoner Restaurant and Tavern.
Now, just give us a brief idea of your background. You're not from here.
No, I'm not originally from here. Originally from New Jersey, the Jersey Shore. But
where?
Red Bank.
Okay.
The Sandy Hook area.
Yeah, okay.
So I grew up, started at the age of 15, washing dishes in little seafood places. Hook, Line, and Sinker was my first one.
Great name.
Oh, yeah. I swore I would never work in this business ever again because I hated it. But I kept needing more money, so I kept going back and went from dishwasher to busboy to, you know, I waited some tables and bartended and did all sorts of stuff. And then eventually went to college for physical education. I was going to be a gym teacher.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But I ended up, again, needing some money, so I started catering. And the guy I'd worked for went to CIA, and he suggested I go to school for it because I was pretty good. So off I went to CIA in upstate New York. After that, I went out to San Francisco, and a buddy of mine got me a job as a barback. So I went back to behind the bar again, and then shortly after that, they made me a manager.
What restaurant?
At Scholar's Bistro.
Oh, we've been there.
Yeah.
We were there with them. They had a woman chef.
We were actually there before that.
With Jen, yeah.
There was a guy before that.
And there was a guy before that. Who was also
really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's overlooked. Yeah, don't you think it's overlooked?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great restaurant. It's constantly going. That place never stops.
We enjoyed it. Yeah, we liked it a lot.
We enjoyed it both times. We really did. That's why he went back a second time.
Well, did the whole California cuisine thing modify your Jersey orientation?
It did. I was in the front of the house at that time, and actually I wanted to immerse myself totally in the restaurant business to learn everything I could. I mean, I'd known a little bit about the bar and wanted to learn more about running a floor and running a restaurant. So I actually oversaw the bar and the floor for service, so I got a good feel for the whole package. And then after a while, I went back into kitchens and worked at a very California cuisine kind of place. I worked at Mecca as a line cook.
Uh-huh. I know.
With Mike Fennelly.
I remember what happened to us at Scala's now. Remember what happened. That was the place where the waiter kept on bringing out food, and we told him, basta, no more, when he didn't tell the kitchen for two more dishes.
Oh, yeah.
it was a little bit like dining at the Commoner.
Yeah, you guys have a history of being overfed, it sounds like.
It happens.
Yeah, it's a professional hazard.
So,
right.
So you were on the West Coast, and how did that's the headquarters of Kimpton, isn't it?
It is. So yes, Scala's is a Kimpton restaurant. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that was my first venture with Kimpton. So I was with them 2.5-3 years then, and then I left, and then I came back to them again. So I've been with them just about 10 years total now.
That's a long time for a chef. Yeah.
Right. Well, I've had the opportunity to work at 5 different restaurants for the same companies.
Each one's different, though, right? Every city is different.
Everything's completely different. Yeah, we don't do the same thing twice. It's kind of my philosophy with everything too. I don't like to do the same thing more than once.
You get bored easily, huh?
Yep.
Well, did you have a lot of input into that open kitchen, industrial chic design, huh?
Started asking me questions about, what do you think about this? Would you like Would you think this would work in Pittsburgh? Cause they knew I'd been to Pittsburgh quite a number of times, and this was before I'd even signed on to be the chef. So I kind of knew they were going to ask eventually, but I did get to have some input. It's really a great thing when you have input that early, and everything from the music to the plates and the flatware, the glassware, had the uniforms, everything I've got to put my hands in and touch, and it really makes it cohesive that way.
You don't wear whites, do you?
No, I don't. First time I made the decision, we're not wearing whites.
Well, that's good. I might have a hard time picking you out of the group because you look a lot like that bar manager.
Yeah, we get that a lot.
And you had the same outfits on, so. I mean, I get a lot of fun out of that whole place. So busy, and it's so vibrant. I just love it.
Yeah, it's really what we wanted to do. We wanted to have an upbeat, fun, lively place, and the cocktails and the beer program and the food all plays into that. It's all meant for sharing, and it's a fun place.
Well, you've been swamped. Had friends stop by on like a Monday or a Tuesday night, I guess Tuesday night it was, and there wasn't a seat available.
Yeah, it's been hectic the first couple of weeks.
So people should make reservations, basically, huh?
Yeah, we have reservations booked. We're not booked solid, but we have reservations booked all the way into the summer already. So.
Oh, wow.
Well, you and knows someone who does a lot of catering for weddings. And apparently she has several weddings
booked
at your place.
Yeah. And we might as well say that the Commoner is the name of the restaurant. The hotel is the Monaco, right?
Yep, the Hotel Monaco. Yeah, so.
And it's
so
quirky.
I get to oversee all that. Yeah.
It's quirky, and I want that flower chandelier.
Yeah. You need to have a good chunk of extra change to get a chandelier like that.
I mentioned, yeah, I know that. Okay, well, you say you wanted the Commoner to be fun, and I'll tell you, we went for that press dinner, and we had a ball. Everything was just, I love your flatbreads to start with.
They're
so ubiquitous that basically, you have to do something to perk them up the way you did. What do you do with those? They're so good.
Well, it starts with the dough. I had a friend that was a pizzaiolo, and he did this little trick when he didn't have time to use a starter all the time for his doughs, and he wanted to impart a little bit of that depth of flavor. He would put a little bit of white wine in it.
So really?
I used that trick in my dough.
And then
just using really good products. And it's fun. It's a broccoli and cheddar flatbread. Just kind of, it's got that comfort and warming sensation of stuff you remember, and it's just, I think it's fun.
Yeah, the only problem I had was avoiding wearing it.
Yeah, well, you Peter's timid about that. He's English, and
well,
everything requires a knife.
I don't like to get food on my clothes. I do it anyway, but
I don't care.
I try to avoid it as much as I can.
I used to have a dress designated for tacos.
and then of course we went on to some really great appetizers.
You talk to us about the food concept. Before you do that, talk to us about the cocktail program, because that's rather exceptional also.
Josh Holliday is our mixologist, and he does a really good job of putting stuff together that pairs really well with the food and is kind of really food focused cocktails, which is great. And
none of this sweet crap. I mean, we had the old fashioned, which is your signature, right? And it doesn't sound like it would be very good, but it was fabulous. Smoky pork belly infused bourbon, oaked maple house made barbecue bitters. That's a lot.
Yeah, we like to play with food in our cocktails.
Right. And then you have some good solid beers.
Oh yeah, the beer program is great.
I love
the one called Breakfast Stout.
Yeah, that's right. I like that circle. I liked it too.
Just my idea of how to start off the day.
roughly 100 beers total, and we really wanted it to be a beer focused place because I love beer, so it was probably more of a personal thing. But so I've been picking and choosing beers and putting them together since I got here in May. So I have a lot of passion about that beer program.
Well, it's fine. And what is the concept behind the food, which I found just absolutely wonderful? I wish I were there eating right now.
Well, I love braising and slow cooking and smoking, and as much as I can do to impart layers and layers of flavor into kind of these simple comfort dishes. And I really drew inspiration from a lot of taverns and pubs from around the world.
Uh-huh.
A lot of English and Scottish and Irish influences,
yeah.
as well as some really good American taverns. And a little bit of French brasserie thrown in there, just for fun.
Now, let's see, we had pork cheeks as an appetizer.
Uh-huh.
And I was really surprised. I was so impressed with your chopped liver. Why was I so impressed with you? And chopped liver is not exactly the most knock-your-socks-off dish, is it?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I take liberties with some words. It's not a traditional chopped liver. I make a bain-marie-style chicken liver mousse.
Okay.
And then I take other bits of livers and lightly poach them in brandy.
Oh, wow.
And fold those in. So, yeah, you get a better texture and all-around flavor.
Now, the other dish that I appetized that I thought was wonderful was the smoked beef tartare. Boy, was that good.
Yeah, and like I said, I like smoked meats. I like all that kind of stuff, and I love beef tartare, so I figured I would just put the two together.
with black garlic aioli, amazing. And the poached
egg. Yeah, I love the depth of flavor in the black garlic is really complimentary to the beef.
Yeah, you know, when they started out, the Korean duo that started marketing black garlic, they were going to market it as a health product.
Yeah.
Chefs will go nuts for this stuff.
It's supposed to be a health in Korea. It's viewed as a health product.
Well, but I mean, their strategy had to involve the chefs who were dying to get their hands on this,
right?
So anyhow, I'm looking at what else we had. You have the way the menu is divided. You have nibbles, then you have slurp, which is self-explanatory. Except, you know what? I didn't get any oysters. Everybody was raving about the oysters.
You'll have to come back.
Okay. Talked me into it. And then chomp, which we had that romaine salad, didn't we?
The romaine salad and the hearty green salad was out there as well.
Okay. Oh, I remember the other green salad.
Yeah. And then you have a section called graze. Tell us about graze.
Graze is basically vegetarian section, so it's all vegetarian dishes that can also be kind of like side dishes as well. I don't like the traditional this is an appetizer, this is a side, this is soup and salad. I like people to be able to mix and match and play with things the way they want. I'll put lots of stuff out there. I'm not going to tell somebody how to eat it. So if you want to eat dessert first, go ahead, by all means.
Now, what section is the lamb shank in?
The lamb shank was a, well, that's Elysian Fields lamb. I mean, you'd have to really go a ways to ruin one.
But what section of the menu is it on?
Feed.
It's in feed, okay. Because the trick here, listeners, is to bear in mind that if you're going to have the lamb shank, you need to bring three friends.
Right. I really could have eaten the whole thing myself.
Oh, you could. Well,
yeah.
I know you could have. But it would be better proportion for three friends.
A lot of my dishes are meant to be shared. So having three friends and, you know, a couple other sides and a couple appetizers, and you'll be plenty good.
Right. And your Pennsylvania burger, which is local ground beef, and, again, Elysian Fields lamb, which I never know. Since it started, I always knew it as Elysian Fields, and now it's called Pure Lamb something? Or
Pure bread.
Purebred lamb, yeah.
That happened after
Thomas Keller.
Thomas Keller got a hold
Thomas
of him.
Keller. Yeah, I still call it Elysian Fields, too.
Good.
They answer to that, too.
Yeah. And you saw that I tweeted to Elysian Fields and thanked them for the good quality lamb, and they sent a thank you back to me and to you. Did you see that?
Yep.
Yeah.
I did. It was very nice of them.
So then you have steak and ale pie. And the fun thing with this bone marrow, I don't know if you've ever looked at our website, but we have Peter with the biggest bone marrow you've ever seen in your life, at Lake Calandre in Italy near Padua. Anyhow, it's there, and it's hysterical. It was so big. But this one wasn't so big, but you do something really special with it, is you roll a shot of rye into it. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was something we kind of joked around about, but then we tried it one day just out of fun. So,
uh-huh.
Yeah, once you're done eating the bone marrow, you do a shot of rye down the bone. And it really goes well together, like the nice fatty meaty flavors and the little bite from the rye. It's great.
Well, I mean, I think that your ingredients are so outstanding, but you also, I think you handle vegetables very well. You're right on trend with your charred cauliflower. And I got a special kick, having eaten a lot in the South, about your wheat and three, which is a play on meat and three, which is instant heartburn. It's not your dish, but what you get in those places. Did we have desserts? I don't even remember. By that time, I had how many glasses of wine?
There
a cocktail.
There was some dessert.
Oh, a martini I had as well.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
I missed the dessert then.
Oh, you got to come back and retry the sticky toffee pudding then.
Oh, that's Peter's.
I did have a couple of tastes of sticky toffee pudding. And it was very good. In fact, everything was very good, including the environment, the friendliness of the staff. You have a great team, and Pittsburgh is discovering you rapidly, and we certainly will add our endorsement to all the word of mouth that's already out there about Pittsburgh's newest hot dining destination.
Right.
Well, thank you very much.
And continue to have a great time, because you're now interacting with our really great spirit of camaraderie among chefs here, and that's great. Cooking together, you've already cooked Cure, didn't you?
Yeah, I did a couple pop-up dinners with Justin at Cure, so you know I love doing stuff like that. So the more I can get out and interact with the other chefs and do collaborative dinners and have them come to my place and do stuff, you know, we're gonna try to do a lot of that.
Great. Well, listeners around the world, travelers, if you're coming to Pittsburgh, put Hotel Monaco top of the list of places to stay, and don't go out to eat. Eat in. You'll have a wonderful time, just like we did. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dennis, and welcome again to our city, and we wish you a long and successful stay as head chef at the Commoner.
Executive chef.
Thank you very much.
Executive chef. There we go. Yeah.
Okay, Dennis. And if the weather clears and you get an extra table, we'll be back soon.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks, Dennis.
So don't forget, make sure to make a reservation, because this is a busy place. And if you're in Pittsburgh and you're planning to stay at the Kimpton Hotel, well, even if you're not planning to stay at the Kimpton Hotel, you should. And you should not go out. Because if you're looking for a dynamic, vibrant environment with lots and lots of really beautiful tasting food, you have it right there at your doorstep. Right, love?
Yes.
So it's going to be a place where we ourselves go to frequently, and we'll be back with another local secret right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, welcome back to our final segment, and proof once more that On the Menu is a sap for a good story. We've known Chef Chad Townsend here locally in Pittsburgh for quite a long time, and we were surprised when he sort of semi-disappeared from sight, and then he reemerged in plain sight doing something quite unexpected.
With his charming and really smart wife, Lauren.
There you go. Exactly. Exactly. And across the country,
eventually they will
listeners,
get
you are going to have to, as we say, eat your heart out, because Millie's homemade ice cream certainly will be available across the country one of these days, one of these years, but I'm not sure when. But in the meantime, it's a charming story and a great secret for local Pittsburghers for you to figure out how you can get on the list to get some of this delectable product.
Well, Chad and Lauren Townsend, you have great plans. They vary, though, so I wanted to catch up with you and with your latest venture, Taste Your Ice Cream, to find out exactly where you are. And I was a little bit surprised when Chad, who is known as a chef, executive chef, a chef of prominence and accomplishment, who I've interviewed a number of times about other things, decided after he took over as executive chef at Salt of the Earth, which is also a well-recognized and well-received restaurant, decided to just leave. And then I heard that it was going to be another restaurant venture, and then I heard it was going to be custom-made ice cream. Chad, let's start by giving us a little bit about your background, and then I'd like to do the same with Lauren.
Okay, so my background is I'm kind of Western Pennsylvania, born and raised. Grew up a little bit east of the city, but for all intents and purposes, Pittsburgh. Went to culinary school here in Pittsburgh. Worked at some restaurants for some really great guys around town here. Then kind of hit the road to check out some other cities and be a part of some other things for a while. And then ultimately knowing that I'm going to end up back here in Pittsburgh. So I've worked at 11, worked at Salt of the Earth, some smaller kind of family restaurants east of here, and then ended up starting to do my own thing. So that's kind of a short and sweet background on me. All the while just been cooking different places and enjoying it all the way.
And Lauren, you were the stable one in this duo.
But a smart one.
Your background is financial, which I think in this current venture, you're going to need a lot of information about.
That's right. That's right. And I my background is in financial services. So since graduating college 8 years ago, I've been working in the mergers and acquisitions industry, and many of those years spent here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's sort of, this merger and acquisition and the IPOs in the food industry have been startling lately. I mean, have you been following Shake Shack?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How many hundreds of millions of dollars is Danny Meyer's worth?
Yeah,
now?
I've read like $170 million
yes.
now. His IPO was this morning, I think, wasn't it?
I think the number was more like 750,000.
Yep.
I mean, 750 million.
Million.
I mean,
okay.
really big.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the
latest. He is a idol to a lot of people, not merely because of his financial worth, but, you know, the hospitality. I mean, he really changed the hospitality industry kind of in general, especially with Setting the Table. His book has been pretty informative, and I've read it several times for sure.
And he's genuinely a really nice guy.
Yes, he certainly is. He genuinely cares about experience that every single person is having in his place, and so he's made a big impact, and it's made people like me, who for a long time you just thought about the food going out being right, but looking at a restaurant as a kind of a round thing where people have to have a good experience from the front of the house perspective as
right.
well.
Now you read the book, right?
I did.
And
the
most startling thing in the book, and this is just for listeners who may not know Danny Meyer all that well and may wonder why we're being so adoring, it turns out that somebody asks him, or he asks himself, who is the most important person in the restaurant? And everybody, 99% of people will obviously say the customers. And he says, that's not it.
Yep.
The answer is the staff, because if the staff are good, everything else will be fine.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's kind of pioneering and taking that idea that treating these staff well and giving them a livable wage and empowering them to make decisions that kind of held a lot of responsibility to his restaurant. He was one of the first, for sure.
Well, now let's move on to ice cream.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, where did this idea start, ice cream?
So this idea starts kind of in a comical way, I guess. Early on in the spring last year, we had a warmer evening. I had got out of work at about 5 o'clock. Lauren had the day off for whatever reason. I had finished up work about 5 o'clock, which was very atypical.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we decided we were going to go out and have dinner. So we went and we had a nice dinner. And then it was really warm outside, unseasonably warm even. And so I thought, well, we should go try some ice cream. So there was a new place opening somewhat close to our house. And we went there, and we ordered some ice cream. And I always like kind of harder, hard-packed ice cream, as opposed to soft serve.
Oh, yeah.
So we went there, and the guy was scooping Hershey's ice cream out of a bucket.
Oh.
No, there's nothing wrong with Hershey's ice cream, but you can buy it at the gas station.
Mm-hmm.
And why should I pay a guy $5 to, you know, put gas station ice cream in a bowl for me?
Yeah, go ahead.
So then we, you know, kind of set out on this mission. We were pretty disappointed with the fact, because I was naive enough to think everybody or a lot of people made their own ice cream. So we set out on a mission to find out who did, and the results were not pleasing, to say the least. So that's what kind of started the little thought in my head of doing ice cream.
Yeah, well, I told you it really kind of jolted my memory that a few years ago I was doing a feature on Pittsburgh ice cream parlors, and it turns out it used to be a hotbed of small ice cream producers. And for what reason, I don't know. It's like there's this whole bunch of candy companies around Pittsburgh that are owned by Greeks. I don't know. Nobody knows anything about it. But when Reinhardt?
Reinhardt
went out of business. That was the last locally produced ice cream maker, period.
Well, for heaven's sake, Isley's, which used to make Klondikes here, their building is now an office building.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But so you got this idea you were going to make good ice cream. And
yeah.
It's, let's say, first of all, it has its own name, Millie's Homemade Ice Cream.
Correct.
Yeah, and Millie is your grandmother.
Yes, she is.
And you were just honoring her with the name. There's no other reason to give it Millie's name, right?
No, we just thought it my grandmother was a very important part of my life growing up, and so we thought it was a nice thing to kind of give the nod to my grandmother, and she was quite the cook and baker, and so it was a no-brainer. We thought we'll do that, and the name just kind of stuck. It was something we just talked about originally, and the name stuck. People started to really enjoy it, and so we stayed with it.
Now, when you were in the kitchen, you were really insistent on local, seasonal, all those good things that define contemporary American cuisine at this moment in time. How do you carry that over into the ice cream?
It's actually surprisingly easy, especially in this area. Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania in general doesn't really get enough credit for the kind of rich agricultural heritage and what we have to offer.
And dairy.
Eggs.
It's a dairy state. It's like the largest dairy producer, but most of it goes to these commercial, you know, cheesemakers or something. Commercial.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, they treat a lot of people just kind of sell to a co-op and then who knows where it goes. But the ice cream, we're trying to do something that kind of runs a parallel path with what we did as chefs and restaurant owners. And that is to do ice cream that includes fruits and herbs and vegetables and things that are in season, that are mostly local. Now, obviously, there's a lot of time right now with 6 inches of snow on the ground. There's not a whole lot that we can get from around here, but we've been able to kind of juggle where now is the time where we do a lot of things with nuts. We do a lot of things with citrus, chocolate, spices, things like that. So we can do some kind of interesting flavors with dried things and then save the blueberry ice cream, the peach ice cream, the corn, all that for the time when it's at its most ripe and delicious.
Yeah, now, I understand, Lauren, that you're being sent to ice cream school.
That's right, yes. We're looking into a few programs right now. Certainly there's one at Penn State University that's very highly regarded, and there's also one at the University of Wisconsin, I believe, as well. So we're looking at a few programs, but that's certainly the intention, Anne, is for me to go to ice cream school for a week or so.
Now, Chad mentioned that viewing this as an extension of this artisanal producer movement and so forth, one of the things you mentioned was that you have plans for pasteurizing your own milk.
Yes, well, so probably to start, we're not going to pasteurize our own milk. We're going to probably start with pasteurized milk. So from my research and understanding thus far, having raw milk and a pasteurized product in the same facility requires some pretty heavy-duty separation. So eventually the idea is to get raw milk and pasteurize it, but when you combine certain things to make an ice cream mix, so your cream, your milk, your eggs, your sugar, your whatever, they require it to be pasteurized again.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of people will buy mix in a bag, which they don't need to pasteurize. And reading the 1,000 pages of the different milk board codes and things that I've been reading, I understand why a lot of people, it's very difficult. They don't make it easy for people to get into pasteurization. But it's something that we feel like we have to do because to maintain the integrity of calling ourselves homemade ice cream. If we're not making it, if we're just doing it, then we should just call ourselves home frozen ice cream.
Now, you have a somewhat unusual business model for bringing your product to market. Tell us about, I guess, regular customers getting regular shipments.
CSA.
Yeah.
Whether they ask for them or not.
Yeah, so we have gotten into doing a CSA. And so we're treating it as a subscription-based kind of home delivery service. And we kind of borrowed from the standard farm CSA model, where people sign up for however many weeks the farm thinks that they will be having good quality vegetables and whatnot. And so they basically say sign up for 20 weeks for this farm CSA. Every week they get a box. It's a surprise. It's whatever is best at the farm that the farm picks, and they get a little box, some greens, some whatever. So we kind of borrowed that model and are doing it with ice cream. So, for example, right now we have people signing up for 8-week increments. We're delivering 2 pints of ice cream every other week, and it's a surprise every week. So it's whatever is of the moment and kind of at right now happening, that's the ice cream that we're making. And it's been really fun. People really like it because they don't know. They're asking what they're going to get next week, and I truly don't know what I'm going to make. You know, 2 weeks away. I figure it out 5 days out. So.
Besides, if you knew, you wouldn't tell them anyway, right?
Yeah. I mean, it ruins the fun. And people really like that surprise factor of, like, show up at your door on Saturday morning, boom, here you go. And it kind of harkens back to this old-timey milkman delivery
era. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, the flavors, it goes without saying that you're going to be doing quality ingredients to separate yourself out from all these other ice creams. I got chocolate, got pistachio, which is heavenly. I got the grapefruit sorbet, which, of course, is very seasonal. And what was the other one that I loved?
Oat.
Oh, I was going to ask you about the oat. But then I wanted to also ask, are you going to stick to fairly traditional flavors? Because a lot of the do-it-yourself, custom-made ice cream companies today, or artisan producers today, go, I think, as much on the shock factor.
Right.
You know, like the Humphrey Slocum in San Francisco?
Yeah, absolutely. So our idea is that we are going to ideally have this business survive on the fact that we are putting quality ingredients out there. We're not trying to make a splash with putting weird things in ice cream. Now, there are some things that for oat, for example, some people may think that doesn't make sense. I'm used to chocolate chip cookie dough. That's the thing, is we're not going to, we'll have some flavors that are very
more approachable.
Standard,
yeah.
Approachable flavors. You know, I love vanilla bean ice cream.
Yeah, I heard, by the way, that that's your favorite flavor.
That is. I was just going to say, I feel like vanilla bean ice cream, you can't add something to it to make it any better. It's already as good as you're going to get. That is the perfect ice cream. However, people aren't too excited to just eat. I could eat vanilla bean ice cream all the time, every time. But people aren't so excited to just eat that all the time. You know, we're going to have a chocolate, a pistachio somewhat regularly, or hazelnut or peanut, things like that, as well as seasonal fruits. But we're also going to throw some fun things in there. We've done corn. People did not really know what to think about corn ice cream. They loved it after eating it, but that surprised a lot of people.
I had it, and I loved it. I had a corn sundae at a Peruvian restaurant in London that was the best thing I ever had.
Wonderful. It's wonderful, yeah. And so to continue, we're not trying to make some ice creams that's going to surprise the heck out of people.
Okay.
Some people might think, oh, this is interesting. But the idea of the scoop shop going forward as well is going to have things rotating, just like you would a restaurant.
Okay, now you mentioned scoop shop, and that's like where you're going next with bricks and mortar, right?
Yep.
You're almost settled on a place for that, right?
We're very close. I don't want to reveal it.
No, that's all right.
We're close.
But you know, my questions are, how are you going to actually expand the distribution area? Are you going to consider internet? How do people get this ice cream if they're not local? And then that's the one, the distribution thing. And how are you going to adjust the scale and still keep this sort of small homemade touch to your ice cream?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so, you know, as we mentioned, we started with this subscription-based home delivery service, this CSA model, if you will, which has been very well received in the area. Right now, it's only available to residents of Allegheny County, really just because it's Chad and I delivering the ice cream, and so we're only two people, and it's been a lot of fun. And so the next step now is to open a scoop shop, a bricks and mortar location. At the scoop shop, we intend to have a production facility there, so we'll be making everything on site. And eventually, we'd love to sell our product in pint form to a lot of the local grocery stores around Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh. And do you have plans for a national market?
Let's get a scoop shop open.
Yeah, we don't at this point. Right now, it's just we're planning to be a really great Pittsburgh-based company.
But the good news is that you know you can, because people like Jenny's have proven that it can be done, starting out in a very small way like you did. So the key thing is that the product is super good.
And it is.
And we can attest to that. And people, it'll be like Coors beer back in the day, as they say. I wish people wouldn't say that. The Coors Brewing Company actually refused to ship their beer east of the Mississippi. So people used to bootleg it across.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Maybe we'll have ice cream bootlegger.
Yeah,
there we go.
Set up a distribution.
That would make for an interesting story.
Yeah.
Well, listen, when you get up and running, you're going to be just around the corner from where we live, is my guess, from the hints that you've given us. You must let us know so we can put that word out. And in the meantime, all you ice cream lovers out there, you're just going to have to be patient.
Yeah, it's coming.
Yeah, well, thanks, you two. Good talking
to
you.
Great talking to you, too.
Thanks, okay.
Peter.
We'll see you, Peter. See ya.
Bye.
So once again, on the menu listeners around the world, we wish you a happy Valentine's Day plus one, and we hope that you'll continue to celebrate with your loved one from yesterday. And until same time, same place next week, Mrs. Rabbit, you're very quiet.
Is it time for me to say bye-bye?
It is time for you to say goodbye. Do it again.
Bye-bye.